This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today is the 25th anniversary of Elvis's death. Let's hear more from Peter Guralnick, the author of what is generally acknowledged as the definitive Elvis biography. The second volume of Guralnick's two-part bio is called Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley. Guralnick describes it as a story of celebrity and its consequences. The book begins with the 23-year-old Elvis starting his army service in Germany in 1958 and ends with his death in 1977 at the age of 42. This was a time when Elvis went from being a rock and roll pioneer to a movie matinee idol and a flashy Vegas performer. Terry spoke with Peter Guralnick in 1999 after Careless Love came out.
When Elvis was in the army, he was stationed in Germany near Frankfurt. You describe his army experience as very difficult for him. What made it so difficult?
Well, I think there were several things that were difficult. One is that if you think about Elvis, you've got to imagine an only child who has virtually never slept away from home. I mean, he was not only an only child, but an adored only child. And the idea of, you can see from the very fact that when he's in the army, both in Texas and then in Germany, he lives first with his parents in Texas and then with his father and grandmother in Germany. You can see how close-knit his sense of family is and how, in a sense, how self-protective he is in terms of living within a world with which he's familiar. But I think the other thing was that he had had his sense of certainty so disrupted by his mother's death. His mother's death was more than just losing the person he was closest to in the world. It also almost removed any sense, the sense of purpose with which he had proceeded so certainly up to this point. I mean, in his mind, a great deal of the reason for his success, a great deal of the what he was working for was to buy his mother a house, to give his parents things that they had never had. And it all worked out. It was as if it was meant to be. It was fated. And then to have taken away from you at the height of that success, the very person for whom it's all meant, really called into question a lot of basic beliefs. The last thing, which is just as pertinent, is Elvis's identification with his audience. And there was a terrible fear. There was a sense that he had achieved the pinnacle of success, and now he had this terrible fear that it was all going to be taken away from him, and not taken away from him simply in the terms of material success, but in terms of this connection he had with the audience, mm-hmm. with his fans. And a lot of, you know, stars talk about the fans, but in Elvis's case, there was no differentiation between himself and the fans. He saw himself as coming from there and as never leaving there. And the nightmare that he had to the very end of his life, I think he told a reporter about it just weeks before he died, and it was one that came up, I think he told Freddie Beanstalk about it in 1960. The dream that he continued to have was of everyone deserting him, of his being all alone, of the colonel, his manager, gone, and of the fans having left him there all by himself. And you know, whatever you think of it, that was his fear.
Although the army cut him off from everything that had been his life, it was in the army that his life was changed in ways that affected his future. For example, in the army, he was introduced to amphetamines by a sergeant when they were on maneuvers. What was the sergeant's intentions?
Well, I think you've got to look back not only in that time, but on this time. I think that, you know, amphetamines were so commonplace that it would be virtually impossible to escape them, whether you were talking about a college environment, you were talking about the Kennedy administration, where Dr. Feelgood, I forget the name of the doctor in New York, who eventually, I believe, went to jail, lost his license, but who was giving amphetamine shots to, you know, the rich and famous. And within the world of country music, certainly, and perhaps in the world of popular music, they were just so commonplace, it would be hard, you'd be hard-pressed to find who didn't take them. Truck drivers, you know. And so when Elvis discovered amphetamines, here you've got this hyperactive kid who, Scotty Moore talked about having to stop the car on the highway between gigs just to give Elvis a chance to work off some of his energy. He just run up and down the road. And so you've got this hyperactive kid. He's given amphetamines. He's told that they're good. They'll keep your energy high. They'll keep you focused. When you're on all night maneuvers, they'll help keep your weight down. And he bought into it totally.
I want to play another record here, and this is a track that he recorded at what I think was his first recording session after coming back from the Army. And this is a song called It Feels So Right, which recorded in 1960, which you describe as being exuberantly dirty. And it's a really good track with, as you point out, really dissonant chords that matched its sexual message. Anything else you want to say? I've already quoted you a couple of times, but if there's anything else you want to say about this track before we hear it.
No, I like those quotes. But
So let's just hear it then. This is Elvis from 1960. That's Elvis Presley recorded in 1960, right after he came out of the Army. My guest is Peter Guralnick, and he's just finished the second of his two-volume biography of Elvis. Volume 2 was called Careless Love. Peter, I want to ask you a little bit about the entourage that Elvis had around him. And he started this entourage, I guess, after he got out of the Army. You know, friends, bodyguards, people who were always around him. What did he need it for? What did he get out of it?
I think he got a sense of reassurance. He got a sense of having his own values validated in a way. He felt a sense of comfort around it, and he wasn't challenged. He was able to. I think that it amounted to the same thing as what many stars do. He created a portable world around him, so that wherever he was, it was home. And he had done this to some extent before he went into the Army. He had had two or three guys around him. His cousins were Junior and Gene were frequently went out with him. George Klein, the DJ from Memphis, went out with him sometimes, and different friends. But it became a much more institutionalized thing, and grew to the point where he had between 12 and 14 guys with him frequently in the 60s. But what it meant was that he never had to go outside of that world, and he never had to worry about being approved of. He never had to worry about being challenged, and I think it reduced his world to a considerable extent. I think many of the guys would agree that it got old very quickly, and that had Elvis been more outgoing in a social sense, it would have created a more challenging and a more satisfying life for himself.
Did you learn anything new about the details or the circumstances of Elvis's death?
No, I wouldn't. I think they've been fully explored, and I think the book, The Death of Elvis, is probably as authoritative a work as we're ever going to get on all the circumstances surrounding his death.
It's such a kind of ugly death for such an idol to have, you know, to be found dead in the bathroom with his pants down around his ankles, lying in a pool of vomit. It's really so sad.
It is, but, you know, I'm not sure that all death isn't ugly. I mean, you can't prettify death.
Right.
And I think the thing that I found most affecting and the thing that surprised, I guess, as I wrote about this, and obviously I knew what there was to write about. I mean, I couldn't change the details of the story, but what affected me most as I wrote about it was Elvis's father's reaction. I just found that so moving and so overwhelming in a sense.
What was his reaction?
he was just so devastated. He was so, and as Elvis was being taken out, as Elvis's body was being taken out by the ambulance attendants, Vernon is being held back and saying, "I'm coming, son. I'll join you. You know, I'll join you." And but there's this sense of the whole purpose of his life. I guess I came to have a feeling for Vernon that surprised me. This may have been the greatest turnaround in my feelings, because when I started writing the book, the first volume, I probably had the same view as most people. He was this kind of shiftless guy who quit his job, never was too enthusiastic about work, quit his job when his son made it, and, you know, lived off of the fruit of the land from that point on. And I don't have anything like that feeling at this point. I feel as if Vernon worked very hard all his life. He retired every debt. He did everything he could. He sought so many jobs to support his family. But then, after Elvis's success, he did everything that he could, everything that was humanly possible, to protect his son. And you see in that last scene how all that he has done has come to naught. He couldn't protect his son, either from himself or from those around him.
Peter Guralnick, speaking with Terry in 1999. He's now working on a biography of Sam Cooke. This is Fresh Air.